There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. Hour number two of Midday Mobile on this Monday. Glad you're here. Counting it down to Thanksgiving. Hey, I'm Sean Sullivan, guest in studio, Jeff Poor. And also, I want to mention this. Just because we aired that new clip, that is, it may stick around. Of course, the clip from last week I'm so obsessed with Governor Ivey during her pardoning of Clyde and Henrietta, the turkeys from the Bates Turkey Farm, and her discussion of high-stepping turkeys. For sure that runs this week during Thanksgiving. It may stick around longer, but it may also, Dalton, kind of be one of our first nominees for the 2018 Alabamian of the Year. You know, we've done this in the past where you get to nominate and we score and we work that game. And we're going to talk about this later in the week and show you the process here, tell you about the process of getting your nominee in for the 2018 Alabamian of the Year. But I wonder if just Governor Ivey and the turkeys, or the turkeys are separate from Governor, pardoned turkeys could be their own, you know, Alabamian of the Year, because they're high steppers.
They are high steppers. That's going to live in infamy, and it's going to be up there with what's wrong with the beer we got.
That's right.
And
I like it a lot right now.
Alabama floor, right?
That's right. So I think it's a legitimate candidate for Alabamian of the Year, right? The turkeys, they can be in.
Well, you have them every year, though, right?
Well, we'll put them back in. We'll talk about this, but we're going to start nominating people here the next few days and get that process that we work our whole way up to New Year's, and that's when we nominate the Alabamian of the Year. All right, this guy has spent most of his time in the 67 counties of the state of Alabama. I think we can put him on the list as well. Jeff Poor with Breitbart and Lanyap and Yellowhammer News. And I want to talk a bit about the Yellowhammer News angle here with you, too. So... person known to both of us, and you know, I saw it this morning when it broke. Cliff Sims, who, and those of you who weren't listening to the show back in the olden days, but 2016, earlier in 2016 and prior, Cliff Sims used to come on this show a good bit. He was behind Yellowhammer News, and I remember the day he told me. He said, "I'm going to take it." After he had been, I think, a fair critic. You know, that's kind of what I hope to be. Had been a fair critic of Donald Trump as a candidate for the Republicans. I mean, I remember having this discussion as we looked at things through the old lenses. I'm talking about myself, of what makes a conservative, what makes, you know, I'm going, this guy, he fails on this, he's saying the right things now, but here, and Cliff and I would talk about that. And then he calls me up one day and says, "Yeah, I'm taking a job with the Trump campaign." And I said,
"Well, what,
really?"
What had happened was, about that time was when Steve Bannon took over the campaign. And I think Cliff kind of fit a role that Bannon had wanted for the campaign. So that's where Cliff
was.
Came in.
How would you define that role?
It was like a social media, kind of an online presence for the communications team.
Which was a big part of what was explained of how, you know, Trump got his message out.
Well, Trump was tweeting himself, but there were other, you know,
yeah,
aspects.
The Facebook.
You've got to have
they did their own pressers. And,
right.
Yeah.
So he filled that role, and I think that's just kind of, that explains the timing of it and how he got his foot in the door. Because
okay.
if we're, you know, Manafort or Lewandowski,
it wouldn't happen. See, this is why it's so great to have Jeff with the insight here. So he goes, he becomes part of the campaign, and then, you know, President Trump wins. Then he's part of the transition team, whatever.
Right. Remember, he was
seeing
the Mobile thing at Christmas.
That's right.
With the controversial tree.
That's right. He called down here to organize that and a couple other things that they were working on. I know Push for Gorsuch and a couple of things.
Pompeo.
Yeah, right. there were definitely some things that he was part of getting the message back to Alabama. Obviously, they would look around the Trump campaign and say, who's our good contact for Alabama? Oh, how about the guy from Alabama? So Cliff was doing that, and then special advisor, I think, former special assistant to the president. So he was special assistant. And now this comes out today that, and you and I have been talking, you have great connections still in Washington, that he has been out of the Trump White House for what? How many?
It was right after Alabama came up there for their national championship visit.
Okay.
It's about 6-7 months.
Okay, 6-7 months he's been out. And he's been out of the White House and doing some other things, working on K Street, I think. And
right, because he was going to go to the State Department, but I think it was a political appointment, and
he was an attaché to Pompeo of some sort, right? He was
going
to move.
What he was going to do, and it didn't. I think the Senate had to confirm they sat on it, or it got pocket vetoed. Something happened bureaucratically that didn't allow him to go work at the State Department, so he went down the street to K Street.
And
he's now kind of doing, like, I guess, consulting kind of.
Right. Which is, listen, it's the spoils of war. If you're part of a successful campaign and an administration,
right,
there are some.
And apparently he was working on a book.
Yes. Well, that's what I want to get to. So I don't know when. And when I talk to him, I want to know when this all started. He says he was taking notes. Now, some people say they take notes. Look, we've gone through this whole thing. Comey took notes. People take notes. I guess I'm not as good of making a chronology here and keeping notes. But he says he was keeping notes, and then we get the word out that the book release is slated for January. Team of Vipers, the name of the book, and it's My 500 Extraordinary Days in the Trump White House. And this was interesting. I was reading last hour this little author's note here. And I think this, it's funny to look at Mediaite spun it one way, a couple other news agencies spun it differently. And I'm going to read this, and then you and I can, you know, react to it or spin it. Depends on who's listening to us. Cliff Sims writes here, I suspect that posterity will look back on this bizarre time in history like we were living on the pages of a Dickens novel. Lincoln famously had his team of rivals. Trump had his team of vipers. We served, we fought, we brought our egos, we brought our personal agendas and vendettas. We were ruthless, and some of us, I assume, were good people. I was there, this is what I saw, and unlike the many leakers in the White House, I have put my name on it. I think there's jabs flying all over on that.
Yeah, there's some bad blood in the White House and of those in the West Wing, those formerly of the West Wing. I think it was never really, you never really had a clear idea of the leadership, except you had, well, from the get-go, you had Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of, like, you're just asking for trouble. You don't have a clear hierarchy.
Right.
They finally brought in Kelly, and I think they kind of settled some of the things out. But then you had the family situation, and the family situation's a big deal. Big deal to all that White House palace intrigue. So
When you say the family situation.
Well, you say Jared and Ivanka are, you know, employed by the President of the United States. They have a lot to do with the personnel choices, and in some cases, maybe not the big picture policy, but some of the small things.
So they're in there. So we now have the family. We have at least two possible bosses in the world of messaging for the White House. Everybody trying to get the attention of the president.
Right.
And what kind of intrigue? Well, a team of vipers says, we'll talk more about this when we get back, but that book due out in January.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 120 FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Phone number 343-0106, 343-0106. Our buddy Jeff Poore with Lanyap and Breitbart and Yellowhammer News. Speaking of our current conversation in the studio, and people want to catch you online too. Twitter probably best.
Twitter's best. Twitter.com/Jeff_Poore.
And then we can you can see him in here with his sticker. I won't even talk
about
what sticker.
That's pretty mild compared to what it could be.
You start up. We got a football game Saturday
with a jersey on and a eye black and a helmet and I
would love that.
I could have really. All I got is just this lousy on my old travel laptop, a lousy sticker from 2013.
Okay, just saying.
And you're getting all hurt in here.
Yes,
on the Auburn Radio Network affiliate in Mobile.
That's right. Who a dutiful steward of the Auburn Radio Network.
Give us a war eagle,
Sean. Good for Auburn.
Give us a war eagle.
I don't do that. But
how about a war dam?
Yeah, but see, here's the thing, man. I'm like you. We're locked into who we cheer for.
You cheer for your station. You want everybody to tune in to the game.
I do want everybody to listen to it.
It's just a little war eagle here.
You can't do that. Give me a Roll Tide.
Roll Tide.
War eagle.
There you go.
See, all things are even. All right. And don't listen to me. I'm a guy that spent $1.36 on some washer tap screws for my truck. So there they are. The most expensive hardware I've ever bought in my life. We'll probably put pictures of that up, too. Speaking of money, reading through the Mediaite story here about a guy known to both of us, Cliff Sims, who used to have Yellowhammer. And it says, a seven-figure deal. They put it in kind of a jab. They said something like, even a seven-figure deal and something else wouldn't change. Blah, 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 blah. Seven-figure deal for not one of the kitchen table names from the Trump administration. Not at that level, right? I mean, for Alabamians, some people that are politicos in Alabama know who he is, but that's beyond that. That's why he's going to come on the show and talk to him, because I think in this state he has some serious relevance, but they don't give somebody a seven figure deal to write a book just for us here in Alabama.
Well, I think they'll play it up. I think it'll show up in D.C. and it's the same. It's the same crowd will buy this book because they just want to read a book about Donald Trump. They don't care who the author is.
Right. Well, but it may, listen, just reading the author's note.
I mean, who?
Well, that maybe it's going to be one of those books, though, that won't be, it won't be a rip of the president, and it won't be a not rip of the president. You know what I'm saying? It may not make everybody happy.
Who from inside that administration has written tell-alls to date? I'm not talking about the Woodward or Wolf or any of those guys. I'm talking about the guys from inside.
But they're quoting people from inside in those books.
But that's fine. But I'm saying, who's written that first person?
Yeah, you're right. So this would be.
Obviously, Omarosa with her audio recording. So it is you're right. A unique that makes perspective. And maybe that's like he's going to be the first. So, and if it's seven figures, it's probably the low side of seven figures.
I'm just thinking
it might even be a rounding error that gets it to seven figures.
I'm gonna write something if I can get three figures.
You're gonna get a job in the White House.
Yeah, well, I can save it, but I'll give the cut rate version for if they give me $150. I'll write their book for them. All right, so we can talk about that some, but that's coming up in January. Also, want to talk about speaking of Yellowhammer story. I was reading a yours today on Yellowhammer that as people wait, I guess, to see if Jeff Sessions wants his old job back. And I'm one of these people that I think, and I'd like to have this discussion, this debate with you. I think he has a path to victory, a fairly certain path to victory. Jeff Sessions today launched his campaign to get ready for 2020 for that Senate seat, I think he wins.
Absolutely.
You bring all, okay.
Not even an argument.
Okay. So there's a bunch of people who would like to be, let's just say on the Republican side, let alone Doug Jones trying to defend, would like to be that nominee. On the Republican side, they're going, don't run, don't run, don't run, don't run. He has smartly, I think, or his staff has let this drag out some and not said what he's going to do, even though smart people like you and Cameron earlier are saying you don't think it's going to happen. But nobody's announced it. But I read your story of Yellowhammer today. State Auditor Jim Ziegler says people are asking him. He's getting people asking him about, he's flattered about running for Senate in 2020.
He may not be one of the top tier candidates, but I have seen him out there, and I know a lot of people just kind of laugh at him. It's kind of a joke, the state agitator, and I get all that.
Now he comes on the show a good bit. He's had his moments for sure.
I think he will get some votes, and I think in a situation where votes are going to be tight, especially in a crowded field, he's going to take votes away from somebody.
Okay.
And that's going to change the complexion of the race. So, I mean, we can laugh about it or whatever. You can think whatever you want about Jim Ziegler, but if he gets in the race, and I've seen him out, around the state, everywhere around the state, actually, because he's one of these guys like Merrill that actually goes to all these places I would say Merrill, Ivy, Ainsworth a little bit, and definitely Ziggler. You see these guys, you cross paths with these guys all the time. People kind of like don't. He's not quite the quote unquote laughing stock like he is in Montgomery and Mobile. People like, you know, and they have dialogues, and I could see the appeal. I could see where he wins some votes. He has a base. I don't think it's like quite to the level of a Roy Moore or anything, but I do think with him in the race, he'll get some votes, and I think that's enough to kind of move some votes around some other candidates they're trying to get in a runoff or whatever it might be.
Or keep other people out. And I'm not saying that there's any collusion. I'm not trying to intimate anything. But there are certain people it benefits to have Jim Ziggler in versus other kind of candidates. Like, I would say just Bradley Byrne has toyed with the idea. He's right. Having us all wait till January, February to find out if he's going to run for Senate, right?
Well, we know he's running.
Okay, but I'm just
a charade.
Just give me the stage for a second. So he's toyed with the idea of running for Senate. If he is looking at an exploratory way of, does Jim Ziegler help his chances of winning the Republican primary or hurt him? I say it helps him, but
I don't know that that's true. I don't know that it matters a whole lot. So the thing about Bradley Byrne is, He really does well in this part of the state.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder how that translates beyond, because we already saw it once. We saw it in the 2010 gubernatorial race. It didn't go that well. He should have won that by a mile.
But he was, until the barroom brawl and AEA getting in, he was close to winning it.
So, but he's going to have to, he still finished second. So
yeah, correct.
What's he got to do, and is he going to try to go after that more rural vote? And if Jim Ziegler's taking votes away in places like Coleman or Geneva County or wherever it is,
and it would be odd because Jim, obviously, from Southwest Alabama, down here, if Jim would be more of a threat to Bradley Byrne, in AL1, not down here in the Southwest, but,
outside
in Coleman.
Outside of Mobile, even in AL1, maybe he does well. Jim Ziegler's won two races statewide.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think straight ticket Republican voting helps that a lot, but he does have he does have two victories. Bradley Byrne is like what, 0-1-1?
Yeah.
So that, now the stakes are a little higher when Bradley was running, but I think that you can't discount the winning a statewide election and kind of knowing where to go, what the meetings are, who to talk to, and all these things. Now, where he's not going to do well, I don't think he's going to raise a lot of money. I don't think he's going to raise any money. But I think that he is a variable. He is a factor in a crowded field, I believe. I think he's in the top five or six, maybe.
All right. So let's talk about who else might be in there. I mean, yeah, you mentioned just passing Will Ainsworth, and talking about Lieutenant Governor. And what would he be setting? I mean, would he be setting anything up here? He's taking his swipe at Doug Jones?
I mean,
it seems like you could just do that as a Republican. That doesn't mean you're going to run for an office, right?
He might be dipping his toe in the water just to test it out. I think a lot of people are looking toward 2022, assuming Shelby may very well stay in the Senate for the rest of his life. But if he doesn't, and that opens up, then that might be where Ainsworth's shot is. So, but let's think about that, though. Like, I do think Ainsworth, it's curious, he raised a lot of money for kind of a, would we argue that the lieutenant governorship in Alabama is kind of a largely ceremonial office?
Unless the governor is forced out of office, yes.
But he did it in that interview that you're quoting about with him taking the swipe at Doug Jones. He kind of talked about how the lieutenant governor plays a role in reapportionment. If we lose a House seat,
which is right now, y'all, I would, and I'll get your vote, but I would say there's looks like better chance of that happening than not happening, that we're going to lose a congressional district.
If we lose this House seat and the lieutenant governor's office has a role in that, all of a sudden becomes a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's maybe, looking at it now, it doesn't look like it's that ceremonial of an office. He's got some appointments and he presides over the Senate, but if he's a player in that discussion.
But wouldn't a reapportionment still be, and I know that there was the what happened, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, with the voting rights and Alabama not being under the the full
the Civil Rights Act of 1965.
Right. Yeah, like, I think, yeah. I mean, there was a change to it, but there still would be, I imagine, some federal scrutiny when you redraw the lines for the congressional districts. There still would have to be.
I think they keep a minority-majority district.
Okay.
Or majority-minority, it's the other way around. I still think what they're going to have to do, because the population of AL7 is shrinking, they're going to have to widen that out. I think they're going to have to run it south of Montgomery and on over toward like Union Springs, Bullitt County, places like that. Well, I think that the real battle's going to be is in North Alabama, Adderholt's seat and Mo Brooks' seat, and I think that's where they're going.
AL5 and AL6? Is that 6?
Six, yeah.
Yes, 5 and 6. And so they'll have to run against each other.
Or does Brooks run for 2020 for U.S. Senate, assuming Shelby steps aside, and then Adderholt takes Huntsville? Adderholt's always kind of had his eye on Huntsville because of all the defense contractors and his seniority in the House.
We'll get back to this in a second.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. Call Sean now at 343-0106.
All right, by the way, too, I put the story up on the Twitter feed. Dalton, if we have not checked, maybe we have it up on our Facebook page as well. That presser from earlier, Baldwin County Sheriff Hoss Mack said four involved in that Baldwin County shooting we were reporting on this morning are related to Julio Jones. I'm waiting to hear more about that. That press conference was the last of the information we got on that. As soon as we get more, we'll pass along to you. Also, my friend in the studio, he works with a bunch of different places you know, like Breitbart and Lanyap and Yellowhammer News. It's Jeff Poor, who is, you were in our area today. What were you doing today?
So Senator Doug Jones was hosting a roundtable at the University of South Alabama about tariffs.
Okay.
So, and the roundtable consisted of somebody from Mercedes, from Honda, Hyundai, two steel companies, Nucor and U.S. Steel, okay. And so a farmer, and the Soybean Association, and it was just kind of, it was a mixed bag of people's different perspectives on the Trump administration's tariff policy. And
did
just,
you get a mixed bag of opinion?
Yeah, you did.
Good.
He did do a press gaggle after the event, and he said that, like, he considers himself a fair trader. I think the big question is how the administration's been using the national defense justification for tariffs.
Yes, because being ready for, you know, we can't have the ability to make steel and the armaments of war in the hands of another country.
Right, but his idea is that you don't leave that in the hands of a White House, in the hands of the administration. You take it out of the White House, put it at the Pentagon, and maybe that takes some of the politics out of it. Now,
then we'll be spending how much for it?
Yeah. There's the threat of the politics being transferred to the Pentagon, which is always kind of a dicey situation. But these are just some of the ideas, at least reining in administrations, because it's not just Trump that's used the national security justification for tariffs. I mean, there have been the Bush administration, the Clintons did it, and so forth. So what's a general sort of way to do it that's, you know,
but it would have the Pentagon in charge of international.
Well, if it's a national
trade,
security,
I mean, would they
it's
sign,
a national, if it's a national security issue,
but what are they gonna
where
go
does
in
it
and,
fall?
Are they going to go in and sign a, you know, sign bills and conquer? I mean,
No. This is that mechanism that allows that allows for, you know, determining if this is a national security threat. It would have to be something the Pentagon would determine and not Donald Trump just decide by executive order.
I got you. So for a tariff to be important, you would get an opinion from the Pentagon whether this sector needed tariffs because it was a national security.
Yeah, I think
they wouldn't be writing the law or whatever. They'd be saying, hey, yes, this is a valid area of concern.
No, right.
Okay.
It'd be kind of like the Department of Justice signs off on some things the president does. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all, obviously, in theory, it's all at the top. It's all the president of the United States runs the executive branch. But, you know, there are certain things that you have to reach out to the attorney general for or to the, you know, the defense secretary for now in this circumstance that you get their opinion on, and that's your justification for, like, firing somebody.
So
or
more an advisory capacity than a legislative capacity.
I think technically it's advisory, but maybe statutorily the idea would be that the Pentagon, that the defense secretary would have to sign off on it. And this is all, it gets muddled, but you got to remember the defense secretary.
DefSec, though, is good. I mean, that's political.
Well, the defense secretary has to be confirmed by Congress.
Yeah, but they're working for the president.
Well, I'm not saying this is the greatest idea in the world,
it's
but
it's just what he's like. I know.
They want that extra layer of, like, checks and balances, I suppose, from within the administration so that Donald Trump can't wake up out of bed. So we're going to put a tariff on kangaroo meat from Australia or something.
Right.
Why? National security. And that way, you know, at least now, like, well, how is that national security? I don't, it doesn't matter. I'm the president. I'm using it. Now,
yeah, there should be a check and balance.
Now, at least
somewhat.
There's the Pentagon saying, yeah, we probably should put this tariff on whatever because this really endangers our national defense. So that's, I think that's where they're coming from. Okay. I you know, I don't know. I think you elect a president. The president ought to have certain, you know.
We should hope that they have.
If Congress gives the president of the United States authority to do stuff, then he should have that. If not, they'll elect a different president. But that's kind of the philosophy there, where they're coming from.
Okay. And that's something that he's come up with or he's signing on to, that there's some...
Yeah, movement. And I think that's one of the ideas. He mentioned, you know, that that's kind of like where he's leaning toward it. But it was that, and it was just basically Jimmy Lyons from the Port Authority, mm-hmm. really down on the tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
Really down on the tariffs. Like I said, the only people there that were really on board with the idea of the tariffs and how they've worked well were the two steel representatives, the Nucor guy and the U.S. Steel guy.
That would make sense.
The agriculture people, not so much, not the automakers either.
You know, you wonder if it's a zero-sum game. And I'm thinking about this conversation I had with a friend of mine. He's a contractor the other day and said, you know, we're talking about house rebuild prices and all that. He's talking about how much the tariffs have increased the price of raw material, lumber,
right,
for him. And he said, but I'm still behind it because the business is so good, right? It all gets made up. While he has higher cost in his raw material, and obviously you, as a guy that has a degree in building, you get it at a level I don't.
Right.
He's got those costs, but because there's more activity and more competition in the marketplace for remodels or building new houses or whatever, it's out in the wash, and probably he's to the better.
Well, the big thing right now is the soybean price.
Mm-hmm.
So the Chinese aren't buying our soybeans, and it's just bottomed the market out. That's really hurting the soybean farmers. What about the people that use soybeans here that make soy milk or whatever, mm-hmm. soy sauce or whatever it is, mm-hmm. that manufactured here? I don't know what that looks like, but they got to be like thinking, this is really great for our business. This is really great for our bottom line. I mean, I think there's gives and takes in all of these things. Now, I think this particular panel, it was a panel just to see how it impacts Alabama. But when we look at the big picture of things, I think there's, you know, there are all kinds of different consequences, some good, some not so good.
Right. Yeah, there's winners and losers in every day in the marketplace. All right, and I want to get to this, too, before we go to the break, because I want to get some calls on this as well. You were in town last week. You were at that LDOT hearing for the new bridge down in Gulf Shores. Now, this is something people have mentioned to me over time, and yeah, I kind of understand what's at question here, but you have a real good handle on it. Explain to me, what are we talking about here, this new bridge for Gulf Shores?
So this new bridge for Gulf Shores, and there's a lot of things going on here. It's a bridge that's going to be kind of between where the existing toll bridge is now and that Highway 59 bridge is.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be kind of in the middle there.
Okay.
It's going to be a spur off of Foley Beach Express, right?
Okay.
And it's going to go over the Intercoastal Waterway and tie into Canal Road.
Okay.
So there's a lot of different discussions about this. Statewide, there's a campaign against it because they don't think that this should be a priority.
Yeah, they're running ads in Birmingham and Huntsville against
right.
it, right?
So
yeah.
They're running these ads against it, and that's why Jim Ziegler was there, I think.
Yeah.
But locally, the idea for me in attending this was just to kind of see, is there any kind of, well, what is the local, what do the locals here want about it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I changed my mind on it. I was kind of against this bridge.
Okay.
But when I got there, you see overwhelmingly the people in Gulf Shores and Orange Beach that pay taxes that live there, the two mayors, Kennan and Kraft.
Kraft, right.
They want this bridge. If they want this bridge and they're the elected representation and they say this is bridge is the right bridge for us, then and the people seem to overwhelmingly agree. It was like 80-20 split of
okay.
the locals that wanted it versus the people that didn't. Then give them their bridge, right? They have a tax base that's extremely important to the
state.
This
is the cash cow of the state.
The tourist economy, you know, that's the biggest part of the tourist economy in Alabama. If this is the bridge they say is the right bridge for them, why should anybody in Birmingham or Montgomery or whatever doubt this? It's not
because you know, it's jingoistic, right? People are trying to keep the money. They don't want it to go here. They want it to go something else they want.
Right. But this is how we do it. You know, you kind of look to the parts of the state that you need to take care of, and that's one of the parts of the state you need to take care of, I would argue.
And that brings up a bigger question. What do you do? Do you invest the money, the capital, if you're thinking about the private sector, in a area that's making you money? That is the tax receipts coming out of South Baldwin. Or do you use that money elsewhere to fix something that needs fixing, but it doesn't bring cash in? That's a tough question.
Well, this goes back to this gas tax argument where mm-hmm. we're about to embark upon.
Yes.
And where this money is going to be allocated. So, now, my friend Matt Simpson just got elected to the State House. He has kind of an idea that you should take the money and a portion of that money should stay where it's collected, where the gas tax
wherever that gas pump is.
So if it's, you know, Evergreen at the mm-hmm. Love's truck stop, that they should get a Conecuh County should get a portion of it, okay. Right? There are other people in the state that think it should be done by population. Well, that's the case. Birmingham's just going to get all the roads because overwhelmingly it's got the biggest population.
Well, you could argue, but to get the, they're also going to contribute more money because more drivers, more.
Is that true?
Yeah, I would say.
Do more people drive in Birmingham or just more people living in Birmingham?
Let's bring it down here. Something I know. Do more people drive in Mobile than do in Evergreen? Yes.
Mobile and Birmingham are two different. I mean, Mobile's different, I think. It's mm-hmm. a spread out city. It doesn't have any public transportation and it has different needs.
But it's not. Yes.
Right. Well, the Wave bus is not. But you see what I'm saying, though? I think the formula needs to be, you need to tweak this formula in a way that takes into all these things into account. And, you know, understand that the needs are different, and population, I don't think, addresses needs. I don't think those two are you know,
yeah, but
mutual.
Should the incentive be, should the desire be to put the money where the ROI is best or that the citizens need it? Because government and the public sector is not like the private sector, right? I mean, there would be question in private business, I would say, if there was an area of our company here that was, if we could expand it, would make us way more money. But we needed some new paint in the break room. I'd say break room's going to wait. We're going to put the money, you know, in the part of our company that's making more money because we can make more money when we expand it.
But that's
the private sector. Is the public sector on that same?
It's a subjective call. Okay. Everybody has road projects. They think, wow, if we build a road here, we will have economic development.
That's right.
You can't give everybody a four-lane interstate to their little county or their little town, right? Mm-hmm. So you got to kind of like, I think you had to pick and choose your shots. What's our best opportunity? You know, so if the people in Madison County and Limestone County are like, we need a four-lane to get us in and out of Toyota, then you probably need to figure out a way to get that done. I'm not saying that all the money from this gas tax collected needs to be put into, you know, needs to be designated based on where the gas tax, wherever it's collected. But you do need, in order to keep stuff from happening, like the BP oil spill money being taken away from the state,
mm-hmm.
there needs to be some mechanisms in place that keep that a portion of that money there because it's a usage tax. It's a usage tax.
Right, it is. It doesn't bother me as much
if it's
others.
A usage tax, then people, you would assume, if they're buying gas in Greenville, if they're buying gas in Locksley or wherever, then that money, you would have to assume, is going to be used. I mean, that gas is being used by people using those roads there.
Sure, I agree with that.
So that's kind of the philosophy there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the idea of giving a cut to the place it's collected doesn't bother me. Of course, devil's in the details, and that's what Session's about. What percentage is that?
Yeah, but there needs to be these mechanisms in place to make the distribution of the gas tax revenue more fair, because right now it's just a political game.
Yeah, do you think they'll come to a great agreement in Session in 2019?
I mean, I think they will. I mean, they're going to have to pass a gas tax. So, you know, the details are what will play out.
All right, coming right back. We'll grab some calls next.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 152 FM Talk 106.5, and it is Midday Mobile this Monday. Lucky to have Jeff Poore in studio. Of course, he's on with us in the mornings on Wednesday, but in our area, and decided to stop on into the studios. It'll be a chance to. I'm going to get myself in trouble here, but we'll say this. How about a tease? Coming up in 2019, something maybe new to the very long resume you're already toting.
Right, so we're looking at a 3-hour radio show, as if I'm not busy enough.
Yeah, you want one of those? It's good. You're gonna be like the dog that caught the car, my friend.
Right, WVNN in Huntsville on 770 AM 92.5 FM. So that's what we're kind of looking at right now. When we're still kind of working on the details.
Because you got nothing else going. That's probably a good idea. Ben says, let's make Gulf Shores and Orange Beach choose if they want this new bridge to nowhere, because without a new road through the state park, that's what it is. Or do they want a new bridge over Wolf Bay that'll actually help the north-south traffic flow? All right. That's one of the questions, too, is you hear bridge to nowhere, and then you hear, like you just said, you've got 80-20 at the meeting supporting it. Mayors of both, Orange Beach and Gulf Shores saying they're for it.
Right.
Let's go to the phones. David is in Mobile. Yes, David.
Ben kind of stole a little bit of my thunder, because if it's going to end at Canal Road, well, there's only two directions you can go from there, left or right. So I always thought that this project was more of a designed to be a scare tactic for the company that owns the current toll bridge in Orange Beach, to kind of play ball to build a second span or expand their current span to make it into a four or five lane road. And so so why not, instead of doing which would be better? Would it be better to build this span to nowhere, or would it be better to work with the toll company or buy out the toll company and just turn the current bridge and next to the wharf into a multi-lane bridge instead of a two-lane bridge?
Well, what I hear is that the bridge people have offered to add that extra span and make it a four-lane bridge. I think there's some disappointment there that it should have been a four-lane bridge all along, mm-hmm. right? And not go down to two lanes. But, at some point, the other big thing that's really pushing this is, I think there's first of all, they think that 59 bridge is going to – it's 50 years old. It's getting kind of up there in age.
It's one of the ones the gas tax will be talking about.
Well, so if you got a barbed or something that bumps into it, then all of a sudden what happens? So you have public safety concerns, right? Mm-hmm. So I think – there needs to be a third option. So, you're from South Florida, and mm-hmm. you drive along A1A, and you go back and forth from A1A over to the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a bridge every 3 or 4 miles, right?
Yeah, or Causeway Bridge, yeah.
Something like that, uh-huh. right? So I think the idea is to kind of mimic that, but you have options. So inevitably, maybe they do add making a twin span at the toll road. But, going to nowhere, I think that's somewhere. I mean,
but it's not connecting on through to the terminus.
So Tony Kennan, the mayor of Orange Beach, told me that that is going to happen, that they are going to make that road go through.
Even though the law says no.
Even though they'll change the law. They'll do what they got to do to get, because now that golf course is closed, I think the writing's on the wall for something to
Didn't
change.
They say something like they could follow a power line right away or some kind of
That's
semantic
one of the other,
thing.
Yeah.
Let's go to Mike in Citronelle. We just got about a minute, Mike.
Why can't they invest that money in the bridge over the ICU bridge instead of worrying about a bridge going to nowhere? Something that'll actually be useful.
Well, I think all of this stuff is already in motion. I think the I-10 bridge is going to be the I-10 bridge. So investing the money when the money's already there becomes kind of a moot discussion. The bridge to nowhere, that's a whole different thing. So it's kind of like
they're separate pots of
right,
money. Right.
What is predetermined for these two projects that you can't really conflate the two at all?
Yeah, I've been told, speaking about the, I'm waiting to see, because I've had many people on record. I say many. Two of them that on record have said in 2019 you'll see dirt moved for the I-10 Mobile River Bridge project.
I believe it.
Okay. And I should believe it. I'm just, I've just been here so long and heard so many times.
They've been dealing with crossing that bay for the last 150 years.
Right. Right. Well, I'm positive. Hey, we got the water taxi that leaves
None of these solutions are ever sufficient to get us more than 3 or 4 decades. When mm-hmm. was the last time the Wallace Tunnel was completed in the 70s?
Yeah, well, that was, yeah. And the problem is you can't deal with for today. You got to deal with what happens down the road. But you know what? People don't want to finance something that happens they're long since in the ground.
But a tunnel is not something you can easily expand.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, that's, you know, what are you going to dig, a third tunnel? I mean, maybe?
I think the bridge is on. And tell people, I'm positive about the idea of having a bridge. It's not, doesn't mean I'm anti-having a bridge. It means I'm cynical about timelines because I've been made that way.
And the new Africa Town Cochrane Bridge.
Right.
I remember when they built that. I mean, like, all these solutions. Before that, it was, before that was the Bankhead Tunnel and the Causeway. Mm-hmm. Before that, it was ferries. Before that, you had to get on a steamboat and go somewhere. I mean, like, you've had been dealing with this problem since the end of the Civil War. Why not think of something that's going to get us maybe 100 years down the road and not just 30 years down the road?
Well said. All right. Online?
Twitter.com/Jeff_Poor.
If we don't talk to him before, we'll talk to him on Wednesday morning right here at FM Talk 106.5.
And War Eagle.
At Roll Tide. And happy Thanksgiving.
Something like that.